everybody. Thank you. Sorry for our lateness. Rose, if you want to explain.
Yes, we already opened the meeting and then went to, into executive session pursuant to the roll call vote for purpose of discussing personnel, specifically employment. And now we're back into the regular general meeting.
Thank you very much. So let's please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Do we have a motion to approve the minutes from our previous meetings?
No. Seconded.
All in favor?
Aye.
And we'll roll right into the new business, please, Brian.
You're ahead of me.
Ready to go.
I have to get to the page here. I can read it out there. We are, so the very first action item is the change order. It's bid number 6215, asphalt pavement improvements. What we're doing is we're adding to the current contract, and we are bringing it into, this is in the Hogsback area. Is Jim here?
Yeah.
Jim, go ahead. You just cover while I'm trying to get to the page here.
Morning.
Yes, please.
Yeah. As part of the original package, we put together a drawing for the Hogsback that was bid as an alternate B, came in a little higher than we were willing to accept. We went back, revised what we were expecting to do out there, and got an additional cost from the contractor for the $61,000 that you see in front of you. It's going to address safety issues that we have out there currently, and it's not going to impact the long-term effects when we do the bank stabilization down the road.
This is also one of the projects that's kind of in our long-range planning of adding a potential all-purpose trail connection down through that area as well. We've had some instability issues, but this will get us a little bit of time while we're trying to work through some of the other areas. So I am actually now on the right page, which is very helpful. Page one, action item four, change order number one with cargo pavement is on the bottom of page one.
Move the motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Action item B, page two, this is just a bid modification for printing and mailing services. This is just an additional estimate. Total revised amount, $116,548.07. Recommended actions, middle of page two.
Move the motion.
Seconded.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next general action item is C, 2017, Cleveland Metro Parks Group Healthcare Benefits. Matt is coming up to give a breakdown. I have to give Matt and Harold, the benefit study team, all kudos. They've worked very hard at bringing this proposal to the board for hopefully adoption today, and then we can work on the rollout to all of our employees. So, Matt?
Thank you. Good morning, Commissioners. It is not our time yet again to review our health benefits plan. By way of background, we are a self-insured medical plan under the laws of the state of Ohio. We recommend itself a self-funded health insurance plan. Basically what that means is we pay all medical costs dollar for dollar up to a stop loss deductible threshold, which is currently set at $125,000 per claim. We do contract with an insurance carrier. They do not provide insurance, but they do provide access to their network, administrative services, claims management. The additional benefits that we do provide, including dental, vision, life, long-term disability, flexible spending account, are on a fully insured basis that we pay per employee per month. As I think has been presented to you over at least a couple of board meetings this past year, we have experienced some pain recently in our healthcare cost. This is a brief or a five-year look back at our per employee per year healthcare costs, and as you can see, we've seen a significant trend increase over the past 2 years. And this is particularly feels more painful in light of the really remarkably low place that we came from. We actually saw a reduction from 2012 to 2013. This slide is kind of interesting. If you look here at the bold line, that is the CERB, which is the State Employee Relations Board statewide average for public sector self-insured plans. While our trend has been drastically higher over the past 5 years, we're really just basically regressing to the mean as far as the statewide average for healthcare plan costs. And I also note down here, this is the Mercer Midwest Region. Mercer is a survey of predominantly private sector healthcare plans. And really that cost differential right there is in the private sector, you're seeing a lot less rich plans. Employees bear a much higher percentage of the cost in the private sector for healthcare plans, and that's what really explains the lower cost. Government sector benefits traditionally a little bit more, are a lot more rich as far as the employee benefit goes, which explains that generally average higher cost.
Matt, the experience going from 9,000 to 13 to almost 14, that has been not so much the cost of medical services, it's more of the experience of the experience our particular group has had, right?
Exactly. I think if you look at it, I mean, the general trend here, this is a pretty good trend number for the state of Ohio, 3.6%, and we're at 10%. So, you know, you can explain about 7% of our increase just to our unique claims history, which has been, over the course of the past 2 years, truly catastrophic. We have about 9 last year, and we're probably going to hit 9 this year, that are over $100,000 in and of themselves each claim. So.
But out of 700 employees, that's not very much, is it?
No, I mean, typically a plan our size, we have about 550 people on the plan, employees on the plan. We would expect to see about 3 on average that would go above 100,000. Last year, for example, those 9 constituted 26% of our spend. So
yeah.
9 employees or 9 claims, not necessarily employees, it's in fact more of them are spouses, are constituting about 26% of our spend. Which is a bit unusual, but at a plan of this size as well, there's a lot of ebb and flow to it, and we're hopeful that we can head back to a little bit more of that flow in the near future. But we can't rely on hope, and you know we do, again, hope that we have a better year, but we have to be out in front of it. We've made a lot of adjustments over the past 5 years to the health plans to create a more equitable shift in costs between the park district and employees to brace for what we anticipated was some general increase to the plan cost. And we are proposing doing that again this year. And then in 2017, we're proposing some plan design changes to both deductibles and out-of-pocket maximums on our A and B plans, which represents about a 1.5% cost shift from the parks budget to employees. Again, these plan design changes are very much in line with the general market increase as demonstrated by that same CERB report. You know, as the cost of MRI 3 years ago, the last time we changed plan design, you know, that MRI that cost $2,000 3 years ago now cost, $2,400. So a $300 deductible, with inflation, doesn't really make sense to continue that. There needs to be some level of increase periodically to keep the plan moving along with the general cost increases in healthcare. We are proposing increasing our stop-loss deductible to $150,000. When we looked at the numbers that came in, that will realize us about $140,000 savings in our stop-loss premium. And we think, based again on our size of health population, that we will not exceed 5 stop-loss claims next year based on our analysis of our projections forward, which would then render us a savings on that decision. We are proposing a 22% premium increase this year. About 10.1% of that premium increase is tied to our general trend. The additional amount, we've been very fortunate over the past 2 years that we were able to utilize approximately $2 million in reserves that we had built up to offset some of these cost increases. However, as Karen has reported out, that fund is going to be essentially depleted by the end of the year. So we are proposing about 10% of our premium increase to replenish those reserves to a more conservative amount going forward. We are also implementing some cost containment features through our health plan, more prior approvals for outpatient services that we think will save us 1 to 2% on our plan. We're continuing to educate our plan users on better consumerism and enhancing our well-being programs. Going forward, some of the things that we may consider down the road, additional plan design changes if necessary, spousal restrictions, which are becoming a lot more common in, even in the public sector, and looking at some narrow network options, partnering with MetroHealth on a potential HMO-type plan in the future to try to save costs.
Matt, how effective, how much use is our telephone operation?
We see really, I think, good usage. 100 to 150 employees per year, I believe, is approximately the number. And when we look at, you know, the associated cost of ER usage, office usage, and urgent care usage, we're really low to benchmark in those areas. Those aren't our cost drivers right now. We're doing really well in that area. It's really the catastrophic inpatient surgeries, hospital stays that's really hurting us right now. So I think the use, we're no longer with Teladoc, we're with a program called MD Live, which is through Cigna, which is virtually identical to Teladoc. We've seen usage. I used it this past weekend.
Is that a reactive use? In other words, you've got something and you call in instead of going to urgent care, or does it also involve any wellness proactive?
It's generally reactive care. It's typically, I think, primarily sinus infections. Antibiotics are the number one prescription coming out of that care.
But that alone is significant.
And we see, actually, our new MD Live program allows for Skype. So video chat, so if you have a rash, employees are able to get that treated, they can show a picture of it to the doctor. So that has saved us a lot of emergency visits, a lot of money in that area. And so that has been a nice feature.
I'm forgetting, did we have a smoker's an incentive not to smoke?
Yes, we do have a wellness incentive not to smoke, and you know, primarily driven at the employees hired prior to 2013 when the general smoking restriction went in place. We do pay a monthly premium rebate to employees to sign a non-smoking affidavit.
And we have several other wellness programs, correct?
Yes, we do. We have a primary care incentive. So while we do value the MD Live and Teladoc type programs, we do want employees to have a relationship with a primary care doctor, so we incent them to get there. Basically, their primary care doctor has to sign an annual wellness form that says, not only am I getting my physical, but I'm getting my cholesterol tests, my colonoscopy if it's required, all the age and gender appropriate requirements are being met. And then we also have incentive participation in health risk assessments and other behaviors, which we're now using them to drive our programming when we're reaching out to employees. I think the action item will be approval of the plan for 2017.
So thank you. Start on the Google page portion, page 5, and then work its way through some of the various services to be provided.
I move the motion if there's no additional discussion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you.
Excellent job.
Yeah, really comprehensive job. That's terrific.
The award of recommended action for the bids, various office supplies, and the NCPA co-op 645, bids 6223 printing and mailing, co-op 6228 for new Toro Roommaster mowers, and then the National IPA co-op for various lamps and balances falls in the top portion of page 7.
It's unbelievable how much these lawnmowers cost, isn't it?
Well, I will tell you, the answer is yes. And what I will also tell you is that, you know, Sean and all of his team should be commended in the years that they've managed to keep those. The average is about 5 to 6 years. And for them to keep them, you know, since 1998 tells you the kind of care that these that the staff has taken of these machiners. These pieces of equipment. So when you're spending that amount of money, it's something that you are really working to take care of, and I commend them for the work that they've done.
On top of that too, Brian, them mowers that are being replaced, the old ones, some of them will go. We're keeping some of them home because we've taken such good care of them that we're going to use them over the center or somewhere else. So three of them mowers will stay with us. One of them has some problems that will probably go to auction and get rid of them. So even though we're getting four new ones, and then these mowers have over 6,000, almost 7,000 hours on each. So yeah, you equate that to mileage, you're talking 400,000, 500,000 miles on the mower.
Yeah, well, good job.
As we're doing the growing down there, we'll use those older pieces of machinery to work through, and then they'll transition out at that point in time. Recommended actions on top portion of page 7.
Move the motion.
Second.
All favor?
Aye.
Approval of vouchers and payroll.
The vouchers listed in Resolution 1610.61 have been reviewed as to legality of expenditure and conformity with the Ohio Revised Code.
I move the motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Excellent. We have with us this morning a couple of employee guests that are coming out of the golf operations. John?
Good morning, Commissioners. It's my pleasure to introduce two of our food and beverage teams. To my far right is Ben Smith. Ben is a chef. came to us from another country club up in Sandusky. He lives in Lakewood, so every day we traveled back to Sandusky and back, and so I'm sure he's glad he came on board with us. But prior to that, he worked at Plumbrook Country Club out in Sandusky. He was started out as a sous chef and then was the executive chef there. Spent some time out in Seattle and San Diego in California working, so now he has come on board with Katie Petrano and it heads up our food and beverage team at the golf courses. And with taking over Sleepy Hollow this year, he is a big part of that, because now we've delved into weddings and baptisms and all kinds of things that are going on in that room there, and that's worked out real well for us. And right to my right here is Sir Keith Bush. He started about 2014, Keith started with us, and this is a real nice career story for this young man. Started out as a seasonal worker and just kept working with us through the summers and things like that. And from there went to a variable employee, then to a part-time employee, and just recently just hired him as a full-time employee. And you can read all about it. But one of the things I'm gonna tell you a little bit about him, when Keith first came to work for us, he worked at Shawnee Hills. If you've ever been to Shawnee Hills, it's kind of remote from any public transportation. At the time, Keith was living in the city of Cleveland, had to get out to Bedford. Take him an hour and a half, 2 hours to get there. So if he started at, you know, 6 in the morning, he's leaving the house at 4 in the morning to get there. There was times at night when he worked there and closed the golf course, the restaurant, at 10 o'clock at night, he wouldn't even get home till midnight, and just by taking public transportation. So he's come a long way. He's a great employee, a great thing. He drives his own car now, he's happy. So we're really great to have both of these guys on board. And another thing, this year you can see our numbers were not as great as we'd like to see them during July and August. We were hit, but the food and beverage department has really given us a shot in the arm. What these guys are doing, Katie is doing, has really put some dollars into our bottom line to help us get through. And they're a big portion of us going into the black by the end of the year with these two gentlemen right here. So, anything said?
I just want to thank you guys for the opportunity to work here.
I just want to say this is a quality organization, and that everybody that I work with in the food and beverage department has been great. It's been a test of the summer. It's been long hours, but I just want to say that I'm thrilled to be here and have an opportunity to keep growing.
Thank you very much, and welcome. I see Katie didn't come. She must be working with Candy.
Covering the fort.
The next information item we have is very interesting. It's part of the Euclid Creek Greenway, Euclid Creek Central Middle School property. This is something that came forward through the superintendent of schools and informing relationships. Stephanie and team, and now Sarah's going to give a little bit of a background of how we've kind of ended up with this portion of at least an information item. This is kind of a precursor to a levy campaign that is on the ballot currently in the city of Euclid. So, Sarah?
Good morning, commissioners. Great. So I'm going to talk to you about the Central Middle School site that is in the city of Euclid, part of City of Euclid City Schools. As Brian mentioned, this is part of the Euclid Creek Greenway. And this is a proposed connector that would go between the lower portion of Euclid Creek Reservation and then up to the upper portion, the lakefront portion of Euclid Creek Reservation. This was initially studied back in 2007, but has been kind of a goal for a very long time, showing up on some of the earliest maps of the Park District. So we have kind of worked around the alignment over the years, and this is the current proposed alignment. But one of the features of this alignment has always been going in the Euclid Central Middle School site. It's one of the only areas that you can really get close to Euclid Creek within this proposed connector. And just for reference, the connector is a little over 2.5 miles in between. So we approached the City of Euclid Schools about a potential easement through the area. This is Euclid Creek Reservation down here. This is the Central Middle School building and their play fields back here. So we had originally approached them to see, could we perhaps get an easement through over like that for the connector trail? And it came out that they are looking to consolidate some of their buildings. They had done this a number of years ago for their elementary schools. And so they are proposing to take down the Central Middle School site if their bond issue passes in November. It's a very large bond issue, almost $100 million. But it would include demolition of this site. And one of the things that we found out is that we actually used to own that site. Doing some research for the trail, found out that there is a, this was deeded over to the schools 50 plus years ago. And so there is a reverter on the property that if it ceases to be used for school functions, that it would come back to us. And so we've been in talks with the school district, with the superintendent, and came up with a very conceptual plan of if that happened and if this site came back to us, what it might look like. So this is just a very, very conceptual rendering showing the trail going through and the building being gone and just having a passive recreation space on the site. So this is something that, again, the city schools have to pass their bond issue and get the funding to do this, but this is a kind of long range view of what might happen at the site.
Ultimately, where would access be from Cross Euclid?
It would be, there's actually a crosswalk right now that's right there. We'd maintain that, yeah.
Is there potential in the future to do an underpass?
There is a very large water main that goes through here because the water treatment facility is here. If you did, it'd have to be over. We could look into bridges.
So there's no way to go under it, would have to be an over?
You could possibly do it through here, but the creek is not that deep through that area.
How about in other locations? Now, Euclid Heritage Park, that's the city's?
Yes.
So, okay. Anyway, that's clear to me.
Yeah.
Sarah, can you go back one slide? Back?
Sure.
Just looking, obviously this is a great, great investment for us if we could do it. But the question I would have is you follow Euclid Creek. I mean, I see on the other side of Norfolk and Western, it looks pretty, it looks like it's not really very seriously developed. And we looked at following the creek.
Yeah, we have, that was actually part of the original study back in 2007, is looking at going underneath the railroad tracks here and then going behind the water treatment facility. That's the Nottingham Water Treatment Facility there.
Where is the Nottingham? Where is the water treatment?
Upper left corner.
So you can see kind of on the aerial.
In there, yeah.
Right through there. So the original had been going behind there. That's not where the city wants to go with it. The water treatment facility actually has a very large front lawn area that they have said they would use and allow an easement to be placed so that you'd have a little bit more visible access. It's not a very developed area, as you said. There's not a lot of eyes on the street. And then there's concerns with the water treatment facility for Homeland Security going behind it.
I see. Okay.
But the alignment still needs work. This project doesn't have any funding behind it. And so this is something that we would want to develop. This Euclid Creek Greenway is number 10 on our trails matrix, but once you take out the things that have dedicated funding, it's number 5. So it's
so
pretty high up there.
I assume that the levy would have them take the building down, take the football field out. What would they then leave afterwards, or is it too early to know that?
Too early to know. They want to have passive recreation space there. That's what we've talked about. And so they really want to focus on, can this even move forward?
Right. But they definitely would remove all the structures and
yes.
everything and leave us with an open space.
Yes.
It's actually interesting if you think of, you know, the studies going back to 2007 and now all of a sudden, you know, components are starting to move forward. You think of the 17 acres, then you think of the work that's been done, then you think of, okay, how do we, you know, in the trail matrix, you know, where does it fit, you know, how is it moving up? And then if you think back in 2007, Euclid, you know, Beach Creek, Wildwood Village, it didn't exist, and now all of a sudden, you know, fast forward to 2016, that's now a bookend. And so now we're starting to fill in that corridor connection along there. And I like your point about the, you know, using the stream corridor. I remember we've dusted this off a number of times and looked at it, and that is really tricky to get back there, and when you walk it, it's even a little bit more hairy. So the fact that they were allowing us to come on the front and then actually bring it down actually helps from a corridor perspective to bring it in.
Well, on the flip side, it gives more, exposes more areas where you can make other connections, even though you don't have the same.
It's interesting, having gone up and down in the Ohio Erie Canal Reservation just in the last couple of days, watching how many of the the workers are using the trail during their lunch hour, and you look at through the industrial area, you know, it's not always just connecting residential. If you have a half hour, 45 minutes of your lunch break, eat lunch, and then use the trail system. So there are components that this actually really handles very nicely for Metro Parks, and the fact that, you know, that 76% of our users identify with this trail experience. So we're actually working on connecting it. And so I think,
in a way, you're widening the greenway.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Can you kayak Euclid Creek down there, or is it too shallow?
It's really shallow, and it's
you'd be very good at portaging, I think, is that where you're carrying more than paddling.
Right. And there's the 2007 study also included a lot of restoration ideas, so this is something that if it moves forward, we want to partner with Euclid Creek Watershed Partnership and see what we can do. They've been doing quite a bit already up in the upper portion of Euclid Creek Reservation.
Yeah, this is interesting work.
Yeah.
Volunteers have done.
Yeah, and so there's a lot of opportunity with restoring the health of Euclid Creek, because it's been, with having the railroad there and the interstate, it's been heavily impacted.
Very good update. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
We will be able to stay tuned to the November election cycle for lots of reasons. Moving into the development of a rare features database, I can tell you out of all the six now going on 7 years, I don't know that I've ever heard of such a thing, so I'm very intrigued, Mr. Mather.
That's why we're working on
it. It's a virtual reality.
That'd be amazing. So we're working on a natural features database, and this has been some work that's an extension of resources has done, that Nadia Arguedas, our conservation planner, has done, to capture those things in a single place, like, you know, these nice cute little neighborhood salamanders, things that are a little, that are quite common, as well as rare features, various charismatic bugs we have, and then also even things which are not necessarily native, but we may as natural resources out in the field and sees things in the field and captures them and captures the record of them, maintaining those records over time in a single location. And I had to throw this one in because not all of them are so charismatic. I'm told this is the coolest. This is the best of the things that come out of our streams, the green cloud of larger. And then also plants. So this is really comprehensive. It could be plants, it could be meadows. It could be natural features like ledges. The idea is that in capturing it in a single location, then we can put together management plans and we can say, all right, this particular feature needs to be, we need to revisit this every 6 months, or we need to revisit it every 5 years and see what its current status is, see what its condition is, and make recommendations about how to address the long-term viability of these natural elements that we're taking care of. So, Natural Resources has just a large range of existing assessments, data sets. So starting with just basic observation, taxonomic observation. So this is, I found this plant here, I saw this animal here. Some of that data is stuff that for example, author experiences is collected over the years. It's in paper form or in spreadsheets or in old databases. So this is about centralizing a lot of that. We also have natural heritage data. Natural heritage data is data that's collected by the state, that maybe the Museum of Natural History had a collection license or found a particular specimen on our site and forward that information to the state. And then there's, you know, in the world of apps, there's iNaturalist, which is this incredibly crowdsourced online database of all sorts of observations where we've got really high quality observations, everything from high quality observations to people like me who don't know what they're doing. Putting data into iNaturalist and the ability to filter that and use that and develop that. And then we've got all the stuff that Natural Resources does. So on the aquatic side, we've got four different assessments that they'll do, and in the process of doing these, they find organisms, they find these things that are happening. And then three additional ones that are done on occasion. And then on the terrestrial and wetland side, you've got a whole host of other assessments that are done. Right now, these are a variety of forms and long-term. These will be in a centralized database of their own. Some of these are already on their way. I'll have vegetation index, biotic integrity. We've been working towards getting that into a database over the past year, and that process is going well. But long term, then all of these different data sources then feed into a natural features database that allows us to centralize and understand what's happening with these natural features and monitor them over the long term. So that's sort of the overview. I'm going to get a little bit detailed.
So what species is this? And then what additional names does it have? So this in particular is a buttercup, a flowering plant actually, I don't think we actually have this record that I know of. It'd be really cool if we did, apparently. So who is it? What is it? How is it special? Is it rare for us? Is it rare in Ohio? Or is it something that's common? And then what's the location? And this is beyond just the geographic coordinates, this is beyond just the mapping, but also how accurate is that location? Was that captured with GPS or was it sort of described? Do we have directions to that site and a description of the site so you can actually navigate to it? We'll capture the demographics of that. So in addition to who is this, what is it, how many are there? How many adults, how many seedlings in the case of plants? How many plants that are senescent, that are dying at the end of the year? And then what's that overall context that it's in? So is it growing on these kinds of soils? Is it growing under this kind of tree cover? Is it growing in this kind of position? Which helps us also long-term predict where we'll find other instances of this within the park. And then what are the threats? So this is a really important part. What are those things, what are the potential threats as far as browse from deer or from invasive plants or earthworms that may make this population smaller or cause other issues with it in the long term? Then we get sort of the who, what, and when of observation. Who grabbed it up? Who made the observation? Who are they affiliated with it? Is it one of our people? Is it Museum of Natural History? Is it a botanist from another external organization? Is it just someone from iNaturalist who happened to stumble upon this? And then in the cases where we actually have vouchers for these things, where a specimen was collected, how do we find that? And then finally, the really important part, how do we monitor this over time? So what's the suggested occurrence monitoring frequency? How often do we go back to that site? And what are recommended immediate actions? And then the long-term vision is that not only do we have this tool that allows us to do all those things, but we can take those individual occurrences of a smallmouth salamander, take those individual occurrences and put them together in aggregate, do reporting on them. So to say, here's the really high quality stuff, here's the stuff that we really need to protect. And in a sense, we have this already, so we've gone through the process of creating these sensitivity maps. But long term, we want to make sure that that's tied back to those individual elements, so we really understand the relationship between these. And that process, the process of collecting this information, updates and improves the mapping and the understanding of where our really sensitive and precious areas are. And then internal contributors. So Nidhi Arguedas has been the lead on this. She's been drafting the actual database design, looking at the biological aspects. Claire Weldon and John Rainier have been absolutely critical in giving feedback on plants and aquatic organism tracking needs. And then as we build this out, we'll continue to work with natural resources with Pat Lorch on the research side and Terry and the architect and this overall and making sure that it meets their needs.
So that's incredible. Yeah. How many different types of entries do you anticipate having?
I should have a number. It's a good number. When we lay out sort of like the whole database structure, we would have to print it on a large poster. Because you've got flowering plants versus,
How ultimately do you digest all that? I mean, it almost sounds like you need an army to go out and handle what you're going to discover.
Well, so the nice thing is we've got an army. So we've got the folks who are already putting information into iNaturalist, and we've got Museum of Natural History that's already plugged in, and we've got natural resource staff.
So you really encourage you out in the community at large then to provide feedback. You're giving people tools to be able to report into this.
So the nice thing is that's already happening. So in the case of iNaturalist, there's already tools for reporting into iNaturalist. So we'll take a dump from, we'll grab the data from that, filter it so that it's all the best stuff, and use that to inform what we look for in the field. And we've got all the work that's already been, I'm sorry.
And then we send that information back out. So.
That's a good question. I think those details we'll have to figure out, like what gets back. I think already staff are
the interactive.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's the existing army of seasonals and our full-time staff and natural resources who are already coming upon this data, already collecting it, and we just need to make sure there's a process for them to be able to report that.
Wow, good for you.
Yeah,
great. Cool. Great.
Thank you.
That was the end of the information briefing items. There is no old business.
Do we have any public comment today? Marty, good morning.
Good morning. Getting another gold medal is admirable, but please give credit to the bottom of the pyramid. Your employees out at the reservations, whose hard work supports everything else. There are fewer of them, doing more than ever before. This time around, public appreciation seems to have been overlooked. They well deserve our praise and thanks. It appears that increasing fees for ordinary park users, picnic pavilions, etc., are underwriting VA-free productions with much setup and cleanup time and pricey performers. If anything, it should be the other way around. Food concession profits certainly don't cover the costs, and the legacy reservations often seem short on workers and rangers during Edgewater events. Entertainment is not part of the park's mission, though it may be enjoyable, especially the smaller venues which bring folks into natural settings. Idea: instead of begging yet again for donations to repair the Fort Hill steps, which are basic park infrastructure, you could set a donation box out at Edgewater Live or Neocycle. Nature and education should be free. Years of prior levies were passed in support of these uses and facilities. Trails and trail users. It struck me that there are basic differences in the users who walk or ride horses and those who mountain bike on trails. Riders and hikers seek a quiet, safe experience. Mountain bikers frequently seek speed and thrills and brag about their wrecks and injuries. This creates a real conflict. Quiet users don't spoil the biker's experience, but one encounter with a bike can quickly make a good ride spoiled, or worse. The Royal View approach is fine, just keep them separate. You spend vast amounts on activities which attract raucous crowds. Leave us some quiet places where we don't have to deal with noise and look out for speeding vehicles. You know, a peaceful park. Thank you.
Can I ask a question, Brian? Edgewater Live is self-supporting, isn't it, largely?
Yes. I mean, I have not seen this year's numbers, but historically that has been the goal of that particular location. I'm not exactly sure what raucous events Ms. Lesher is commenting on. Maybe we need to ask her specifics, but I mean, I will tell you that the events that have been put on, you know, by Metro Parks have been very well attended at all locations, whether it be Stinchcomb or the Conference Series at Lookout Lodge or wherever we have had that. So I'm not so sure that I would agree with that statement. But in general, you know, the pyramid for the good of all, the good of some, and the good of one, we've really worked at, you know, large events. There isn't some cost recovery. I mean, if you look at Cedar Valley Settlers Day, there has not been, you know, much of a cost recovery. Brecksville, you know, the settlers. I mean, so in general, we provide a lot of those. Bugs City, the pin that I'm wearing today, was, you know, free events. And so we kind of changed the model a little bit with the changing demographics and what people are looking for. We've also looked at, in, you know, the nature centers in particular, for the good of one, like if you're learning how to use a camera or something like that, then you would have some cost recovery associated with that. So in general, I think that was one of the assessments that we looked at, you know, when we did the SWOT analysis a number of years ago, that we were not really looking at any mechanisms for cost recovery. And the reference to the gold medal, you know, when I talked about it, it is for this community, and I highlighted the employees, and so I'm not going to take offense to it, because yeah, I definitely highlighted that this is for management, and it is because of the support that we get from this amazing community, and the community has responded through social media. I mean, it was trending on social media, meaning people really deeply care about and have a large affinity towards this park system and the work that the body of this commission has done, putting it in the national spotlight.
And I think the concept of Edgewater Live, and even the one, the east side version of it, should probably be self-supporting. And I think we've gotten rave reviews. Everyone I've talked to, that's a plus that has been a definite plus for all involved. I wanted to comment on the mountain biking. There are a lot of different groups of mountain bikers, and I for one, I like a nice quiet ride through the woods, and it's not although I'm crazy about about the trail in Strongsville, Royal View. I think it's that I see people walking on that trail, and also it's a bike trail, but I see people walking on it, and it's the way it should be. But I think these passive trails, even these wide pickup truck wide horse trails, are a lot of fun to ride on, but you're not crashing through the woods. You're riding along at a normal pace, and there are a lot of us as we get older that are handicapped in the sense that we can't walk long distances, but we can ride a bike, and that's the case with me, with, you know, two fused ankles and all the baloney that goes with you know, a misspent youth. I think it's helpful to have that available to us. So I don't think we should class mountain biking is the challenging mountain biking. I mean, it's fun to do a downhill race at Vail, you know, where you're going down the road at 35 miles an hour, but we don't do that in the Metro Park. There are places elsewhere for that.
Just as the party, again, we were down in St. Louis, and we were recognized now for the fourth time as the Class 1 National Gold Medal. And again, thanking all of the staff, which I do every month in my YouTube videos that I put out, the work that this team has done. It's interesting when you're in that company and you see who you're up against, and Minneapolis was one of the competitors, they were excited when they got their letter, and as we were as well. And then the statement was from the executive director was, and then we saw your name, and then we realized that we were in some very tough competition. And so, you know, from a national perspective, the stage that had been set prior to me coming on board, and the work that this team has done to carry that legacy forward, is truly remarkable. And it wouldn't be possible without the citizens and the board support to carry out the mission of the park. So thank you for that, and the award is for all.
And congratulations to all of us. Absolutely. That being said, our next meeting is October 27th. We are going to go back into an executive session for an additional purpose. Rose?
Yes, and I just want to underscore that, yes, this all-staff video, Brian emphasized immensely the staff's role in winning that award and thanked all the staff. So the purpose of going to executive session, we want to continue our discussion regarding personnel, specifically employment. We also have some litigation and collective bargaining issues to discuss.
All right, we will not take any action. You're welcome to stay if you'd like to. We will come back to you.
A motion and a roll call vote.
Going back, motion please to move into executive session.
Move to go into executive session.
What she said, second.
Debbie Berry?
Yes.
Dan Moore?
Yes.
Bruce Rinker?
Yes.
Perfect, thank you all. All right, thanks everybody.